Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of this, the political year of the outsider, as Bernie Sanders surprises the pollsters, pundits, and Hillary Clinton in Michigan, and Donald Trump steamrollers towards the Republican presidential nomination, crushing his opponents while defying the Republican establishment as he cowers and controls the press. Thomas Ferguson, a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Massachusetts and a contributing editor to The Nation, joins us to discuss this boiling electoral brew of disgust with politics and politicians, and who best could blunt Trump's drive to landing that prime property and piece of real estate at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Then, with momentum coming out of his upset win in Michigan, we will look into Bernie Sanders' chances of winning the next big prize, Ohio, then Illinois, and speak with an expert on elections and the Electoral College, Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice, and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. He joins us to discuss the similar conditions of vanishing manufacturing jobs that exist in the industrial states of Ohio and Illinois that have catapulted Bernie Sanders to victory in Michigan in spite of a similar double-digit deficit in the polls. Then, with the Colossus to the south finally paying some attention to its neighbor to the north, we'll discuss the state visit by Canada's handsome young Prime Minister Justin Trudeau with Cleo Pascal, a visiting Trudeau Fellow at the University of Montreal Centre for International Studies. She joins us to address concerns Canadians have that the election of Donald Trump will cause Americans to flood into Canada, and short of that, how Canadians would feel if a fellow Canadian, Ted Cruz, ended up in the White House. And joining us now is Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He is a contributing editor to The Nation and the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi there.
And it's looking more and more as though Donald Trump is unbeatable on the Republican side. I don't know whether you saw his press conference at his one of his golf course properties at Jupiter, Florida, after his win in...
I saw snatches of it.
Well, it
like
was
the sort of these days, the American political imagination works in almost hallucinatory snatches repeated on clips and things like that. That's what I saw.
Well, it was pretty extraordinary that he's hawking Trump steaks and Trump wine and all of this sort of petty details about the, his businesses that have been questioned by Mitt Romney and others. But the one thing that struck me as being extraordinary, though, was, and I don't think any other politicians ever exhibited this extraordinary control over the press. He has total contempt for the press. He doesn't avoid them. He embraces them at all of his rallies. He has a little press conference. None of the other candidates want to have press conferences. He embraces them and absolutely humiliates these reporters. And, you know, you get the feeling that maybe a lot of them are a coward because if he doesn't like the question, he might sue them. So have you ever seen anything like this?
Well, not right off, but I don't think No, I'm just trying to think. Although I frankly am always impressed by the deference with which most of the press treats most billionaires most of the time. I mean, there's an occasional exception, you know, but fundamentally, you know, you may just be seeing a carryover from that. They're not quite used to the role of actually asking an intelligent question that would be penetrating. The other point to remember here is I know it is said how the press, I mean, they all love to pretend that they're fighting, and to some extent that's true. There was certainly a squabble with Fox News and things like that. But in truth, you know, I'm not the first person to notice that, you know, in the polls for a very long time, Sanders and Trump were about the same. Sanders gets nothing like the press attention that Trump does. And my conclusion from that is that you've got a bias, partly conscious, partly unconscious, partly structural, in the press. That's just all there is to it. And, you know, it's not obvious to me that Trump is all that much better copied than, say, Sanders is. I mean, he's occasionally asked reporters questions like, you know, why are you asking me this question? I'm really running for president of the United States. Couldn't we talk about something serious? I remember that one from somewhere I saw. Anyway, it seems to me we ought to look at the Trump phenomenon in some detail. And let me tell you what I think is behind it. The first thing you want to recognize is the point that my colleague Walter Dean Burnham and I made together in our piece in Alternet back after the 2014 election, which was the enormous fall off in the turnouts on both the Republican and the Democratic sides in state after state. And, you know, we drew the conclusion then that the relations between the party establishments and the mass base was hopelessly broken. We just said it as plain as that. And I actually think that has, you know, that's exactly right. That's the point of departure. Now, then the next question is, so how does this get us to Trump? I think in a couple ways. First thing to understand, the most important thing is that Trump's a billionaire. Now, and people will say, nah, it's his press. Nope, he's got a billionaire. This makes the following condition almost unique in American politics. He can say anything he wants. He doesn't really need anybody's money. And thus, he is free to say things like George Bush lied to everybody to get us into the war in Iraq, that he didn't protect America. He can question carried interest if he feels like it, that carried interest tax loophole. He can say something like, we could improve relations with Russia. He can say any number of things, including stuff that, you know, the rest of big business doesn't like, that the rest of us, you know, meaning, for example, if he feels like it, and he does, he can just say, we'll stop immigration. That's not the conventional view in the business community, though some folks have in the past sometimes quietly campaigned for slow rates in periods when the immigration rates were higher. That's not now. So he can say what he wants. And the thing to understand is that the Republican Party nomination process has for a very long time been subject to the, you know, inflexible rule of an investment theory of political party competition. You can only say what you can finance. And so for the Republican Party, that's a very narrow range of issues. It's the usual bromides about, you know, how welfare is terrible, taxes are horrible, the supply side garbage, and all that stuff. I mean, the stuff we've heard now forever. I mean, there are wrinkles on that between sectors, but they're wrinkles. And Trump simply could walk right through that magic mirror. And that's what he did. That's the overwhelming fact here. You know, when the Wall Street Journal and other people tell you that money doesn't matter in elections, get what's happening here, which is you've got a billionaire, you know, who's not politically correct and out of line. That's the basic condition. Now, the next question is, so why does he get this overwhelming response? Because I'm going to take it for granted that it is an overwhelming response. In fact, it's quite remarkable. I was looking the other day at turnouts in the Republican race and in the Republican primaries. They're way up. Even in the Democratic primaries, where you've had, you know, definite mass movement running, that's Sanders, they're actually mostly not up. That's a really interesting fact. Now, what's going on? And I think the answer is straightforward. It's the failure to get any kind of a recovery after the 2008, collapse for most of the population. And it's become unlivable for enormous numbers of people. That very telling graph recently published, which suggested that the white worker drop off, sorry, white worker death rates were high, are places where Trump does well. I mean, you can say all you want about single factor problems and, you know, why it would be good to control for a bunch of things. I suspect that's true. It's a testimony to how just unlivable things were. I had a conversation 6 weeks ago with somebody whom everybody would recognize as a pillar of the establishment. And this guy told me, and I may add, a brilliant and famous economist who held very important positions in American public life. And this guy just says to me, well, you know, people should basically be pretty happy. You know, income is reviving. We're coming up. And I said, you're just out of touch. This is not, in fact, what we've got. And the enormous numbers of people who have dropped out of the labor force, that's the thing to watch, not the measured unemployment rate anymore. No, you're for huge numbers of people, life is becoming unlivable. It, one way of noticing that is to just look over at the amount of, you know, agitation for a minimum wage rise. I mean, that is another testimony to that type of fact. What you've got here, an absolutely amazing phenomenon, which is it only occurs once in a while, where enormous chunks of the electorate are concluding they can't live with the system anymore. They are tuning out, and you got, in effect, a runaway electorate here. I should hastily observe, the guy who first observed that to me was my colleague Walter Dean Burnham again, because he and I talk a lot, but I agree with this. This is looking like an extremely unusual election, and the striking thing is that I think a large number of people are just not going to believe what they now regard as jive. Now, I should continue just for one second, and that's on the Democratic Party side on this, where folks, I don't deny what people are often saying, which is that Trump is more than a little scary. I mean, the racism is impossible to accept, for example. The erratic character of some of his pronouncements, the occasional suggestion you should rough people up who disagree with him at his meetings and things like that, that is scary. I'm not, and in general, though, people are, you know, it does, the comparison, while I think a little far-fetched, is not totally outlandish. There was a buffoon named Mussolini who people thought was a buffoon, except he wasn't. But on the Democratic side, especially for the last 20 years, really starting with the Clintons, which is and carried to a fine art with Obama, the Democratic Party strategists were often quite clear. They actually say this occasionally, guardedly in public, that, you know, they weren't appealing to workers anymore. They were appealing, they quite carefully, and they would occasionally say it, we're going to pick out an electorate out of young people, African Americans, and women, and they were going to go for that. Well, you know, people can read that when you don't talk to them. And if you think in terms not of formal propositions that people are looking over, but like feeling thermometers, as it were, people can tell, even if they don't have a clear idea of what, that somebody really doesn't care much about them. That's the Hillary Clinton problem. I mean, I do not doubt she will now, you know, she's already switched her position on the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement. She will no doubt in the next few months come out with all kinds of pronouncements directed at workers. My bet is it's not going to wash very well. And folks, it may just be past time. But this is an extraordinary situation, and I've never seen anything like it. And I always deny when folks, you know, when my students would ask me, I deny that I saw the sun hit the top of the Great Pyramid the first day. I'm not that old, but I've never seen anything like it.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and a contributing editor to The Nation, and the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems.
So, yeah, one point in, just formally and for the record, I'm now professor emeritus.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, let me fix up your...
And I'm still a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute.
Okay. Well, I get complaints that I read these bios too long. So.
I'm totally sympathetic. Okay. I'm completely sympathetic. We probably should be factually right.
Exactly. Well, let me ask you then, is there a similarity then with what happened to Jeb Bush and what is happening to Hillary Clinton? Is this just a year that people are just fed up with status quo politicians? They're fed up with political dynasties. They're just fed up in general with politics. And as we've mentioned, this is the year of the outsider. Bernie seems to be able to get away with the fact that he's been a politician most of his life.
Yeah, but he's been consistent and truthful. You know, when you ask him about foreign policy and say who has experience, he has a perfect retort. I voted against the war in Iraq. And he was generally not for things before he was against them, and vice versa. He's
right.
been consistent. Everybody knows it.
Right. Well, then.
So look. Do you want your? I'm happy to address your question. On the Bush Clinton. It's true. I think that both Bush and Clinton carry special baggage because, I mean, of the family descended inheritance business. Yes. On the other hand. You know, all the establishment candidates, from Scott Walker to Marco Rubio, they're all going down like tenpins, actually. I mean, the only thing that's keeping Kasich in there until recently, nobody was looking at him. I mean, it's sort of like the last guy standing in a race where you sort of blow off one person after another who appears to be catching up with Trump, and then eventually you get down to John Kasich, you know, not the worst person on earth, but almost unbelievable as a Republican Party candidate.
Well, clearly, the establishment in quotes is begrudgingly turning to Ted Cruz while just basically
giving up on
Rubio, you know.
Yeah, well, Rubio has given up on Rubio. It is said that even his own advisors are telling him maybe he should get out. I think in the next month what you really want to watch is not whether anybody turns to Cruz. I don't think there are going to be very many people in the Republican establishment turning to Cruz. You want to watch the way Trump sends signals to the establishment and vice versa. This guy has a vice presidential race to hook, to name. He can make some other, you know, at one point he let it be known that while he was talking to Rudy Giuliani, I'm not sure that everybody found that reassuring, but it's a fact. And he can let out some more folks whom he's talking to. And, you know, he has a chance to perhaps bring some of these people on board. This is very much worth looking, but it's going to appear mostly outside the media. It won't be something you can read in election returns.
Well, I'm pretty confident, Thomas Ferguson, that the Republicans will coalesce around Trump, and that the problem there is that all of those horrible things that he said are already being forgotten by the press. As I mentioned earlier, he's able to completely cower and control and dominate the press and manipulate them and humiliate them at the same time. This is the tragedy, that nobody is going to be reminding the American people on a constant basis what this man has said. As he becomes more and more the front runner, Donald Trump will become more and more acceptable. He's obviously going to move to the center, if not to the left, in the general election. And frankly, somebody's got to keep reminding people, this is the guy that said this, that he's crushed the spirits of, you know, just as Barack Obama uplifted the hopes and spirits of young African-American kids, this guy has crushed the spirits of Latino kids by insulting their whole ethnicity and culture. He's done the same with one of the world's biggest religions. His actions and rhetoric have been outrageous, and his behavior.
Under no circumstances would I want to be thought to making any excuses for him.
I know, but don't you think in general all is going to be forgiven as he becomes more and more the mainstream candidate of the Republican Party?
Well, like I say, at this point, a very large chunk of the audience, actually in both parties, is fed up, and they're not listening to anything the establishment, including the press, says much now. Yeah, I think in that respect, you're going to enter a kind of funny time warp where things will just disappear. I don't disagree with that. And Yes. I mean, this is an amazing event. I will tell you truthfully, you don't see this very often, but as I read American history, I was just looking over it again in the last couple of weeks when I had time. You get these elections in the 1850s where they just vote out entire legislatures because they're so disgusted. And that type of thing, that's what you see here in national politics. We don't, and the media is to a considerable extent deluding themselves. They're talking mostly to themselves when they, I mean, how many predictions have we had that Trump was peaking? You know, there was another round of them last week. Then he goes in and walks over his opponents. Right? I mean, I know we're on a radio show. I'm still going to say it. There is in Germany a thing called reception theory, and they talk about how observers will pick up different aspects of the same message and thing, especially used in connection with art. That's what you've got here. A large chunk of the audience is now so predisposed, they're so angry, that getting messages to them is hard. And they, frankly, you know, they're just visceral reaction when somebody says Trump is you know, inconsistent lying X is to say that person themselves must be inconsistent lying. I have seen, there's some polls, I guess, that claim that when Romney denounced Trump, Trump's polls went up. You know, well, that's where we're at, folks.
Well, Thomas Ferguson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you, Ian. Have a good one.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Massachusetts and a contributing editor to The Nation and the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Bernie Sanders' chances of winning the next big prize, Ohio, then Illinois. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice, and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. His most recent project is a book examining the Electoral College, which draws upon surveys of presidential electors he has collected over the past three decades. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Alexander.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And now that Bernie Sanders has had this surprising victory in Michigan, a Rust Belt state where he clearly not only did he win over a lot more African-American voters than was expected, he also clearly did incredibly well with young voters and with disaffected white working class voters, the very constituency that Donald Trump is attracting. So he's on a roll. And my sense is that heading into Ohio on Tuesday, he could do very well.
Well, I think in many ways the state of Ohio feels much of the same anxiety that Michigan does, particularly when it comes to manufacturing, when it comes to trade, a number of the issues that both Trump and Sanders are just pounding upon. So we may see some very interesting things in Ohio unfold next week as well.
And is there any possibility that Hillary could pull off Ohio? I mean, my sense is, in the broadest sense, she has a real problem just simply this doesn't feel like the year for the status quo politician or anybody that's been in politics a long time, because the public is so fed up and disgusted with politicians. And anybody that's, even though Bernie's been a politician, he's seen as an outsider. Trump is clearly an outsider. Do you accept that premise, that you've got a very surly electorate that wants change?
It's no doubt that it's an outsider's election this time around. I mean, and even one of the key rivals to Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, is a bona fide outsider. So absolutely, this is an outsider's election. This is one of the things I don't think most people would have ever expected, to see Hillary Clinton basically tied in the number of states won or lost with an avowed socialist, Bernie Sanders. So I think that speaks to, you know, the kind of nature of what's going on right now in the American public, but also speaks to some of the weaknesses of Hillary Clinton as a candidate, that she hasn't been able to shake off Sanders. So I think that, you know, she's facing a difficult challenge in Ohio, but she's also been way up in the polls in Ohio for most of this time as well.
But that's what happened in Michigan. She was way up in the polls by double digits.
Right, and I think one of the things that she probably should really be hitting pretty hard is that, yeah, she can't run from being, you know, part of the establishment. She can't run from being the first lady, from being a U.S. senator, from holding a cabinet level position. She can't run from those things. She ought to embrace them and say, look, this is a time when we need somebody that actually has experience and can work across the aisle. As polarizing as she is, you know, she has shown glimpses of being able to do so. So I think, you know, kind of hearkening back to some, you know, Bill Clinton era politics as well, may be her saving grace at the end of the day.
Well, being in the radio business, I'm familiar with microphones, and I must say it's pretty extraordinary that a politician of her experience doesn't seem to understand that microphones are there to amplify your voice, and the last thing you want to do is shout into a microphone.
Yeah, she, and, you know, this is interesting because even, you know, if you go back to 2008, she was kind of seen again as the experienced one, right? And Barack Obama out-campaigned her at every turn. And it appears as though the same kinds of things are happening this time around. And again, that's certainly a disconnect for somebody who should have that kind of experience.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Alexander, who's the chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice, and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. His most recent project is a book examining the Electoral College, which draws upon surveys of presidential electors he has collected over the past three decades. So, since you study elections and the Electoral College in particular, and one, of course, the ironies of Hillary Clinton's, in quotes, success so far has been in the southern states, mm-hmm. which the Democrats are going to lose in the general election. That's a foregone conclusion, whereas Bernie Sanders is winning in the more important northern states, or many of them, which must wins for the Democrats. And do you see a path forward for him? Because I've been mentioning for some time now that there's some big, you know, collection of voters awaiting in April in New York, which is a pretty liberal state, and California in June for Bernie Sanders, if he gets that far, and it looks like he will.
I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on Sanders, and again, much of this could be up in the air if Hillary Clinton is served an indictment. You know, if she's served an indictment, then all bets are off, right? You know, whether or not he can win in New York, which, of course, Hillary Clinton was a senator from the state, that would be a challenge. This has been, you know, a primary season like I haven't seen before. But you're absolutely right as far as, you know, whether or not you're very successful in a state that you're unlikely to win in a general election probably doesn't matter a whole heck of a lot. So, I don't think that candidates who are, you know, claiming, look at how well I did in Louisiana, Hillary Clinton, for instance, you're not going to win Louisiana general election unless something crazy happens. So, you know, these candidates really need to be very strong in about a dozen swing states. And if they can do that, then they'll enjoy some success.
But where do you get the feeling that an indictment is happening? That's certainly what Donald Trump keeps saying. He keeps saying if she becomes a nominee or if she's not in jail. I don't know where that comes from because we've heard so many, you know, attacks on her for so long.
And Benghazi, of course, they went ahead and had that hearing, and so, and after that she went way up in the polls. There's a lot of smoke there, but is there any fire?
Well, from what I've collected, it doesn't appear as though that will happen. However, the fact that they just gave her IT guy immunity would speak to the potential for that indictment, and I think that's the the fact that there's the door's cracked is probably making a number of Democrats pretty nervous, quite frankly, that's even a possibility. Whether or not that will happen, from what I've seen, even the worst that she might have done is far less than what others have gotten a slap on the wrist for. So that remains to be seen. But it's the fact that there's a specter still hanging there doesn't bode well, again, in an election where people are very distrustworthy of Washington in the first place.
So turning to the Republican side of what might happen next Tuesday in Ohio, your state, Robert Alexander, at this point, Trump is ahead of Kasich by 6 percentage points. But there's, clearly Kasich has banked his future on winning Ohio's 66 delegates. So far, I've been reading stuff saying that Kasich's delusional because he said he was going to win Michigan, which he certainly didn't. Do you think he's got a chance here?
Well, I think he absolutely has a chance here. In Michigan, he was far behind for quite a while. And if you take a look at how much airtime Kasich has actually received over the last few months, let alone in the last few weeks, he's gotten very little airtime. It's really been a kind of a three-person circus, and Kasich's kind of been on the outside. In many ways, Kasich, I don't think he's delusional. In some ways, if he's able to win Ohio, and that's a big if, but if he's able to win Ohio, he very well may be seen as a strong alternative to both Cruz and Trump. Rubio does not appear to be gaining any steam whatsoever, and Kasich's the only one that doesn't have any blood on his hands from these debates. He's refused to engage in the ways that Cruz, Rubio, and Trump has, and so if they're looking for that Republican that probably would strike the most fear in a lot of Democrats, it would probably be John Kasich.
Well, but as the Republican establishment, in quotes, coalesces around Cruz and sort of gives up on Rubio, and of course Cruz was just endorsed by Carly Fiorina, but I believe that Rubio got, of course, a big endorsement today from the Chicago Tribune. But that's been one of the reasons why Trump has had a clear field, is the others have sort of subtract from each other. How does that math affect Kasich's chances in Ohio?
Well, obviously having a pretty open, the fact that we've got four folks vying for the same spot has not done well for, anybody but Trump, right? Trump's been the one person to be able to break through, but it hurts Kasich certainly in Ohio. But at the same time, if he's able to win here, I think that he could see that as some momentum. The way that things are playing out with the delegate math, it does look like it could be very difficult for Trump to get a majority of the delegates going into Cleveland. But a lot of that is going to be up to whether or not, particularly Cruz and Kasich stay in the race. I say that because I'm looking at Rubio, and things are just going downhill very quick for him.
Well, of course, the other state is Illinois, and which is up for grabs, and it certainly wouldn't hurt to get in the endorsement from the Chicago Tribune. But what's your sense about Bernie Sanders' chances there?
Well, again, if you take a look at the state of the race right now, it's a race where endorsements don't seem to have mattered a whole heck of a lot. Mitt Romney came out, had his big speech. He's a former Michigan guy, and the Romney name carries a lot of cachet in Michigan, comes out and essentially supports anybody but Trump, but in particular supporting Rubio, and Rubio flagged mightily. So I'm not so sure how strong endorsements are at this stage of the game, in particular because Trump is such a strong name. He's a strong name. People know who he is. And I'm beginning to think he might have been right when he said that, he could shoot somebody in the street and not lose votes.
Well, it's, as I say, this is definitely the year of the outsider, but the more that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders go at it, what's your sense of whether, they're going to improve and whoever comes out at the end of the battle is going to be battle-tested and ready, or alternatively, are they going to be beaten up and a lot of money is going to be wasted that would otherwise be used in the general.
Well, I think on the Republican side, you've absolutely seen a lot of blood spilled amongst the candidates. In many ways, I think it would be very hard in a traditional, typical election year to have a front runner call another front runner a con artist and then come out and support that con artist. That's troubling. I think it's going to be really tough on the Republican side. The Democrats, for the most part, have spared that kind of volatility. There's no doubt that at times it's gotten a bit rough between Sanders and Clinton, but at the same time, you don't see the kind of personal attacks against one another. I think the Democrats are actually much more disciplined in their candidates this time around than Republicans are, and that's a big change from typical party politics.
So do you think then that given that Trump has sort of run away with the trade issue, even though Bernie's been strong on it, and it certainly helped him in his victory in Michigan, but Trump seems to also be able to add to the trade issue, which is clearly resonating with working and middle-class Americans, he also adds the xenophobic issue, which is that immigration is costing you your jobs as well as them being shipped to Mexico and China, et cetera. That's certainly territory that the Democrats don't want to go near. So conversely, is there going to be a backlash, do you think, of African-American and Asian and Latino voters that could make up for what appears to be a fairly formidable juggernaut in terms of Donald Trump?
Well, I think that's going to be one of the really problematic issues of a general candidacy for a general election campaign for Donald Trump, is that he has made comments and in his announcement of running, he talked about rapists and murderers from Mexico. I think that, you know, the Hispanic population in the United States is not traditionally a high voter turnout population. But, one of the things that's a great motivator for individuals is indeed fear and anger. And I think Trump will probably stimulate a lot of people to get out to vote that wouldn't normally vote. And so I think you're probably right about that you will see that countered from a lot of a relatively high minority turnout in 2016 for the Democrats.
Well, of course, the Ohio Secretary of State, for reasons that mystify me, has decided that young Ohioans who are age 17, that will be 18 by November, have been disqualified from voting in the primaries, even though 21 other states allow it, and Ohio previously allowed it. So what's his motivation there? Is he trying to sort of take down Bernie's numbers so that Hillary gets the nod? I just don't understand it.
Well, I think, you know, one of the issues here is, I don't think that that's necessarily the case, but I think the larger argument is, you know, when you enfranchise more younger people, typically that's going to benefit Democrats. And I think looking forward to a general election, if you're allowing more 17-year-olds, kind of widening that base and giving them more excitement about the campaign, that it will then ultimately affect the general election outcome. So not so much trying to tip the scales for Bernie or not Bernie, I guess tip the scales for Hillary in this election, but kind of engaging those voters in a broader way and then bringing them into the general election. I think there's probably a little bit of concern about that from a Republican Secretary of State.
So just in closing, just to recap the possibility that Bernie Sanders is on a roll here. He certainly surprised the pundits, and I imagine Hillary Clinton in Michigan. He has consistently captured an extraordinarily high percentage of young voters, over 80%. So given all of that momentum, your sense is that he really is poised to do well in Ohio.
Well, I would not have given him much of a chance a week or so ago, but his performance in Michigan, he absolutely outperformed the polls in Michigan, and much of it will be related to turnout. And primaries are a lot about momentum, and winning in Michigan certainly gives him a great deal of momentum. There's been a a real reticence to coalesce around Hillary Clinton. For several years, there's been a real desire to have at least somebody challenge Hillary Clinton. And what Sanders is talking about, in particular about economic inequality and trying to equalize the playing field, resonates with a lot of folks, particularly when they're anxious about economic times. So I think he does have a chance, a much better chance than he had just yesterday at this time.
Well, Robert Alexander, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
I really appreciate it. It's always good to talk to you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Alexander, who's the chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. His most recent project is a book examining the Electoral College, which draws upon surveys of presidential electors he has collected over the past three decades. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Colossus to the South, finally paying some attention to its neighbor to the north. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Cleo Pascal, who specializes in geopolitical security and economic implications of environmental changes from global warming. She is a visiting Trudeau Fellow at the University of Montreal Centre for International Studies and a Fellow at the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House, London, and a consultant to the U.S. Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE, and the author of Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cleo Pascal.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
And Canada's Prime Minister, your Prime Minister, is on a state visit to Washington. It's not often that the Colossus to the South pays any attention to Canada, right across the border, the northern border. But now, of course, there are jokes in Canada that the Canadians are going to build a wall to stop the flow of refugees out of America if Donald Trump becomes president.
That's right. And we'll get the Americans to pay for it.
Well, good luck to you. But seriously, what's your sense then of what – well, let me start with that, the Trump issue. I mean, it's pretty extraordinary to see it happening here in the United States, and I imagine everybody around the world is holding their breath. What are you hearing in Canada about – how the Canadians are going to deal with the Trump?
Well, Prime Minister Trudeau has made it very clear that he'll deal with whoever's in office. I think he raised some issues around campaign financing on the topic on a town hall, Huffington Post town hall. I'm not quite sure what he meant, because in this case, Trump bypassed all of the campaign financing issues by apparently financing his own campaign to a large degree. But that was the only swipe of any sort that he's made. So far, he's been very diplomatic because, as you mentioned, you know, we are living next to an elephant. The Canadians live next to an elephant, and every time the elephant tosses and turns, the mouse in the bed might get crushed. So we're very polite to the elephant in most cases.
Well, but I couldn't help noticing a contrast, though, with Prime Minister Trudeau not just greeting Syrian refugees, but actually going to a refugee center and putting on winter coats on young Syrian children and personally greeting them to Canada. That in contrast to the U.S.'s, you know, more or less the governors and the Republican Congress shutting the door on refugees from Syria. And Donald Trump, of course, calling for a complete ban on Muslims entering the United States. It couldn't be more stark.
It is a complete difference in policy. They came part of the election campaign for the Liberal Party, which is Prime Minister Trudeau's party, was that 25,000 Syrian refugees would be brought into the country, and they reached that goal about a couple of weeks ago. And it's a combination of a unique Canadian thing, which is that community groups can sponsor refugees. So you have church groups sponsoring Syrian families coming in, for example, and government-sponsored refugees. So there's quite a distributed system for getting these people across the country, although there are already problems with housing. Some are talk about housing on military bases and things like that, but it is very, very different. And Trudeau ran a positive campaign, kind of an almost aggressively positive campaign of optimism and hope and, you know, we can be better people and we can be a better country, to contrast to what was perceived to be the negativity of the previous Harper government, the conservative Harper government. And people were very much fed up with the previous Harper government, in part for its anti-science stand and dismantling of a lot of the research centers. So we have essentially a tripartite political system. I mean, there's a fourth party, but it doesn't really matter outside of Quebec. And it could have gone either for the party that's traditionally further left or for Trudeau's Liberals. But Canadians are very strategic voters. And once they saw that the momentum was heading towards the Liberals, a lot of people who might have otherwise voted NDP, which is the more left party, switched to the Liberals in order to ensure that the Harper government was voted out. So this overwhelming shift, the majority government that was achieved by Trudeau, was in very large part a reaction to the previous government. So there is a lot of space for him now to try to implement very different policies. And the question is whether he can do it, given the nature of Canada's economy.
Which is an oil-based economy, is it not?
It's very heavily tied currently to the oil and gas sector. About 20% of manufacturing is tied to oil and gas. The drop in oil and gas prices has decimated the Canadian dollar. It's weakened substantially, which should help us in the context of U.S.-Canada economic relations, because things become cheaper, which is why, you know, for example, you get a lot of television shows and movies filming in Vancouver or filming in Toronto, because you get, you know, everything's 70 cents for the dollar, right? So you get a real big savings. So eventually the lower dollar helps other sectors of the economy, but currently the low oil and gas prices are really kicking the heart out of sectors of the economy, especially in Western Canada.
Well, Canada, I think, is, if it's not the largest supplier of oil and gas to the United States, it's the second largest, I think, maybe Venezuela still, but Venezuela's in such turmoil. There's even a portent of a civil war in Venezuela, which may well affect their exports.
Yeah, and Canada has, I mean, it has, you know, one of Trudeau's first challenges will be pipelines, because the Keystone XL has been killed. And that was a huge gift by President Obama to Prime Minister Trudeau, because it meant Trudeau didn't have to take a position on it. He didn't have to annoy the oil patch by not backing it, so he could, you know, commiserate with the oil patch while not alienating environmentalists and those who care about other issues. There was a proposed pipeline from Alberta west, which would have brought bitumen to the Pacific coast, and that was killed. So now the major pipeline proposed, which is kind of $16 billion pipeline, is to go east to get the oil, because most of our oil is landlocked in Alberta and part of it in Saskatchewan. So it has to go south, west, north, or east, and the current focus is east. And there's a lot of opposition to it. So the question will be what position Trudeau takes on that, especially in light of, I think, what people are hoping will be some sort of climate deal or greenhouse gas-related deal with President Obama.
And what do you think cemented this personal relationship? They only met at the conference recently in Manila, but they seem to have really hit it off. And what's behind the idea that Canada's getting the full court press with a state dinner, et cetera?
Yeah, first state dinner in 19 years. As part of Trudeau's campaign platform promises was an increased a warmer, better relationship with the U.S. And I think that just personally, the two men have similar views in many areas. And I think in some ways, especially on things like single-payer health care, President Obama would have preferred to have gone the Canadian way on a few issues. So I think that there's a dovetailing of interests and approaches and outlooks.
Well, of course, the single-payer issue has now been taken up by Bernie Sanders in his campaign against Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
He's certainly reminding Americans that, not that he wants to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, but it does have its limitations. And it actually has not done what it's principally been aimed to do, which was to cut costs, and because costs have not gone down. And the U.S., of course, spends more on healthcare than any other country in the world by a substantial factor, up to about 18% of GDP.
Yeah. Yeah. And Canada has, you know, a fundamentally different approach in many, many sectors, including healthcare. Canada benefits enormously from having one land border, and that's with, our main security provider, the U.S. We don't have to spend, you know, anything like most other G7 countries on defense because of the American umbrella. And the other thing that I suspect they might be discussing will be Arctic sovereignty issues. There's increased activity in the Arctic with China and Russia, and U.S. and Canada already work quite closely together in the North. And so a better relationship between the two leaders might lead to some innovative responses to that growing challenge as well.
Well, already Canada's Prime Minister Trudeau has sort of suggested that Putin is not dictating terms in the Arctic.
That's right, yeah. But it's difficult because of operational limitations. So the Russians have vast access superiority. They have, you know, nuclear icebreakers. They have submarines. They're actively deploying in the region. And the U.S. is severely limited in terms of icebreaker fleet, and Canada is as well. So, it doesn't have to go straight to military. It can just be better intelligence sharing, better satellites, better use of the Canadian Rangers, which is primarily manned by First Nations in the North and the Inuit. So I think that just kind of more working together in a smart way to at least ensure we know what's going on up there would be very helpful. And with these two particular men in power, I think there are better chances for that. But from a Canadian perspective, you know, we don't have a lot of time with President Obama. You know, Trudeau's in power probably for about 4 more years, and only one of them will be with President Obama. So whatever relationship we build is going to have to be much more broad than just one man and one man.
Well, but if Ted Cruz becomes president, you'll have a Canadian in the White House.
That's right. Do you like our gift of Ted Cruz? We also gave you Justin Bieber, so we're really kind of ramping it up with our exports.
Well, in terms of the defense, you mentioned the disparity in defense spending. Trudeau got a little bit of criticism when he first announced that he was withdrawing Canada's, I think, 6 or 7 F-18s jet fighters that they'd sent to this coalition that's fighting Daesh, the self-declared Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. But he's basically pointed out that actually Canada was able to contribute much, much more useful assets than just adding a few planes when the U.S. certainly is not short of jet aircraft.
Yeah, it's a controversial decision, and Canada was not invited to a defense minister's meeting that looked at the situation in Paris not that long ago, and that was quite, it made headlines in Canada. You know, is Canada not sitting at the big boys' table anymore? It's very unclear what we were contributing and what we can contribute. I feel like I actually really don't know the hard policies of this government yet, and I'm waiting for a budget, which should come up in a few months, that will actually show where they're prioritizing, where they're allocating the money to. But pulling out of the pulling back the fighters was an election promise, which was followed up on, but very quickly then, as you said, followed up with saying, okay, well, we're going to send in trainers and advisors and something very close, actually, to boots on the ground. So it's the promises represented a very certain outlook on the world, and I'm not sure how many of those promises in their pure form will survive current realities. And this meeting with President Obama will tell a lot, and the budget will also tell a lot.
But just when you mentioned Russia and tensions with Russia over their presence in the Arctic and their efforts to open up more of the Arctic to both shipping and to mining, etc., it's worth noting that with Russia's economy and heading into the abyss, and Canada's, of course, as you mentioned, is not doing well because of the price of oil, which is equally affecting Russia. I think Canada's GDP is, if not level with Russia's, even above Russia's. It may be a superpower, but it's certainly not an economic superpower, Russia.
No, but what we're for example, if the Russian economy gets hit, and weakens and doesn't have options in the West, then that pushes it closer to China. I'm not saying it should have options in the West. I'm just saying this seems to be what's happening. The Russians don't particularly like it, but they're especially in the Arctic, where there are entire towns now that are in the Russian Arctic that are effectively being controlled by kind of Chinese nationals, because there's a population crisis on the Russian side and a substantial number of ethnic Chinese that are moving into the region, sometimes on temporary visas, sometimes they're there for longer. So you get you're getting perhaps a little bit of a less control. The mountains are high and the emperor is far away type situation in Siberia and other parts of the Russian Arctic that can lead to greater complications of the security situation in the Arctic. So it's not just Russia, but it might be China and Russia, and it might be criminal elements within both of those countries, or, the lines are very blurred and not particularly well controlled. So, if you get something like a checkpoint at the Bering Strait, you can at least monitor some of the traffic coming in from Asia or coming in from the Pacific, so that you have a sense of what some of these other ships that are coming in are doing and potentially why. But right now, because of actually the U.S. Doctrine of freedom of the seas, there is no movement in that direction. But again, this might be another sort of initiative that you see coming out of a meeting of minds that could help create a greater security situation in the Arctic.
Well, just in closing, in the last minute, with $2 billion in goods and services and 400,000 people crossing the Canadian-American border daily, pretty clear that there's already a fairly substantial relationship. And even though Obama's not going to be around for much longer, Trudeau will be. So just in closing, you expecting something on climate change? Anything else in this from this state visit?
I'm hoping there'll be something on the Arctic. I'm hoping there'll be something on customs. And just to drive Trump crazy, it's worth noting that one of other Trudeau initiatives is to allow extremely easy visa access for Mexicans coming into Canada.
Well, let's hope it does get under his skin. And I thank you very much for joining us, Cleo Pascal.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Cleo Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical, security, and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She is a visiting Trudeau Fellow at the University of Montreal Centre for International Studies and a Fellow at the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House, London, and a consultant for the U.S. Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE. And she's the author of Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.